to What You Missed This Week. I'm Caroline Hyde. This podcast has some of our favourite interviews from the Daily Market Close show that I co-anchor along with Romain Bostic and Joe Weisenthal. What'd you miss? Come on, it's the perfect way to kick off your weekend. This week, well, I mean, it felt more like a decade, really, as the election day stretched into the weekend. Uncertainty, it reigned. But where we did get some clarity was on some of the ballot measures, not just the candidates, that were put to the test with voters on Tuesday, like, for example, the minimum wage in Florida or legalized marijuana in New Jersey. And, well, one of the most high-profile and expensive ballot initiatives, it was Proposition 22 in California. The measure that passed allows ride-hailing and app-based delivery companies to continue classifying their drivers as independent contractors instead of employees, meaning that most companies like Uber, like Lyft, like DoorDash, well, they're exempt from providing their workers particular benefits and protections. These gig economy companies dished out a whopping $200 million to urge voters to endorse the measure. And, well, clearly it worked. Proposition 22, or Prop 22 as known, passed by a margin of 58% to 42%. Now, ahead of that vote, we discussed the implications with Morgan Harper, a senior advisor for the American Economic Liberties Project.
Yeah, thanks for having me. You know, Prop 22 is an attempt by these companies that rely, their business model relies on not giving workers protection, gig workers. And what they are trying to do is evade the very strong protection that the state, California state legislature came out with to force them to classify these workers, instead of being independent contractors, as actual employees and therefore entitled to benefits. And, you know, it doesn't make it any easier for voters to understand what's going on when these companies are spending $200 million trying to confuse the issue and also pressure their own drivers into supporting it instead of thinking through the issues clearly.
Do you think these business models do survive this vote, do change on the back of this vote, whichever way it actually falls?
I think that the businesses will have to adjust because they will be forced to actually treat their drivers, who are essential to the operation of their businesses, whether or not they would like to consider themselves just purely tech companies. They are relying on labor to complete deliveries and also to complete rides. And so, yes, they will be able to function, but they're going to be subject to more competition, which is actually a healthier marketplace. By paying people more, by having workers that have more control over their schedules and all of that, it is possible, but it's going to result in a very different marketplace, but ultimately one that is fair for workers and better for society overall.
I'm just curious, Morgan, I mean, how does this sync up then, this proposition? Let's assume for a second it does get passed. How does that proposition sync up with some of the lawsuits and the other regulatory challenges that had been made earlier this year that seemed to go against Uber and Lyft?
Well, this is their last-ditch effort. I mean, the other methods through the courts have not gone their way. The California state legislature, as I mentioned before, has already acted on the side of protecting workers and forcing them to treat their drivers as employees, not independent contractors. And so this is what you see. It's an act of desperation to try to continue this mythology that they can self-regulate and treat people fairly, and it hasn't proven to be the case. And ultimately, you know, it's going to be a very important moment, this vote, because it will impact what is happening in other places, other states that have also brought lawsuits. There's been a lawsuit in Massachusetts also saying the same thing. And, you know, I think it's important to note here, too, that it's a slippery slope, because when you have one industry that's getting essentially a free pass and not having to treat people like workers, offering benefits and all that sort of thing, not paying into the state unemployment insurance system, which right now we're seeing during the coronavirus is stretched to the maximum, that it hurts other industries that are playing fairly. And so ultimately what we're saying is you need to have a fair playing field, and industries that are relying on labor need to be treating their workers fairly and providing them with benefits.
So obviously no group is a monolith, including the people who drive for Uber and Lyft and so forth. What is your best read on how this proposition is viewed by the drivers who will most likely be impacted by it?
Yeah, there's a range of people that are driving, and certainly a lot of the coverage of the proposition and some of the the messaging that the companies themselves are putting out are trying to make it seem like drivers really want to be independent contractors, that they appreciate the flexibility that comes with that. But the reality is something different. The reality is that most of these drivers are driving more than 30 hours a week. that isn't someone that's just doing it in retirement to make a little extra money. That is someone that is doing it to provide for their family. And, you know, if you look into some of the stories of these drivers, they are ones of folks who this is their only form of income. When they don't make enough money in these jobs, which a lot are not able to do right now during the pandemic, then they are sleeping in their cars, that they can't cover the expenses that come with having to be a driver and the wear and tear on the car, et cetera. So, you know, we really have to, I think, cut through that idea that somehow this is just folks that are doing it on the side, when really a lot and most of the workers are doing it as their primary source of income.
Morgan, this is, of course, on the ballot over in California, but this has perhaps ramifications for all the U.S. And I also think it must have ramifications for the whole of these global businesses, because these are issues being fought over in London as well, over in Europe. How are they hearing about what the rest of the employee base thinks?
Yeah, I mean, this has a lot of ramifications, because if you are forcing these companies to admit that they cannot operate profitably, that you have to actually change your business model, which is fundamentally exploiting workers, then you're going to have other states and other jurisdictions across the globe that I believe will start to also push back and create greater protections, and realize that when you start to take this type of, you know, industry consolidated power on, it's possible. And we'll be inspired to do that as well.
Now, while the winner of the presidential election is still uncertain, it is evident that the blue wave that some pollsters had predicted and the market had priced in, well, it didn't materialize. Instead, it's looking like a divided government, although those Georgia runoffs will yet dictate that fully. But with the prospect of potentially even more gridlock in Washington, we've got some perspective on just how that impacts the role of the private sector and their responsibilities. We spoke with Ursula Burns, a major corporate leader who is on the board of the likes of Uber, Exxon, previously CEO of Xerox, of course, and now senior advisor at Teneo. She's also a driving force behind the Board Diversity Action Alliance. It's a group guiding corporate America to put more Black executives on boards.
Yeah, I divided Congress or not, corporate America's mission and requirements are the same. And that is that corporate America has to devise a plan to be a more inclusive set of organizations. We have to spread the wealth. We have to include more of the population, more of the people in the creation of the company's present and future. That means disabled people, people of color, women, gay and lesbian people, all have to be able to participate in building the great companies that today are largely led and governed by white men.
Yeah, Ursula, I mean, a big part of this election here, this particular election season, to a certain extent had that idea on the ballot, the idea that the direction of this nation might be in the vision that you just laid out. Well, no matter who wins, whether it ends up being Biden or not, it's going to be close. What does that tell you about whether companies themselves are going to be able to take this mantle and carry it forward?
Yeah, independent of the election, if you heard some of the discussions that I've been having, and the discussion and this impetus for the start of this board Diversity Action Alliance, it was to remove some of the burden from government. We saw that government, Republican, Democratic, mixed, split, whatever, was not carrying the weight necessary to drive the change. So what we had over years, generations, centuries actually, was a pretty continuous exclusion of inclusiveness, right? And so what we were thinking of, and I think mixed Congress, same Congress, Biden president, Trump president, even though I have a preference for one and not the other, it doesn't change at all what the need for companies are, and that is that they have to take control of their responsibilities and their participation in the development of a more inclusive world. I'm not talking about being socialist. I'm not talking about taking away a meritocracy, none of that. But right now we have literally a hand on the scale approach, where if you happen to be in a certain class from a certain background, you are passed through the system, and everyone else has to climb these massive walls and contort themselves to fit in.
Yeah.
All we're asking for corporate America, and by the way, it's not me. Corporate America is asking themselves, how do we become more representative of what a good world will look like in the future? The good news is that we are doing that without the thumb on our neck of governments alone. So whether Biden wins or Trump wins, I believe that corporations are going to continue to push for what they know is a more sustainable future for companies.
But what, Ursula, policy-wise, would accelerate, in your view, that process towards a more sustainable future for companies, as you describe it? If there were a legislation, if there were a path open for policy, and maybe there's not because maybe it'll be totally gridlock, what would actually help facilitate that?
I'm not a big fan of government being involved in business only because historically it hasn't helped deeply involved with business because historically it has. But we've seen some pretty interesting examples of what happens when you legislate in diversity requirements. We see it in the UK, we see it in California. Where surprisingly, we find people that we couldn't find before. We find more women. So these types of things where you actually give companies the right for a very, very short amount of time, because they've been at it for 50, 100 years, to actually right their own ship. But if they don't, I think government should have the right. We should expect government to start to get more involved and direct and mandate or legislate towards broader diversity. That's one. We already have a set of discussions around sustainability. You know, how much waste can you produce? So there are places that governments can engage and be helpful. But I believe that if companies act the way that they know that their intellect can lead them, their hearts should lead them to, that we wouldn't need government to actually levy a very heavy hand here.
Yeah.
Companies would know how to do it themselves. But I tell you, I'm optimistic, but not totally yet convinced.
I'm glad you're optimistic, because I want to get to your intellect and your heart right now, Ursula, because you're sat there in London. You moved to London after the last presidential election. How do you feel about America? Leave out corporate America, about America.
And, you know, I am, people would always ask me if I'm an optimist or a pessimist. And I've been thinking about this in my life, and I think that I'm intellectually optimistic, but I'm an emotionally pessimistic person. That's the best way I can describe it. And I think right now I am hopeful that we are on a track that will start to bring us together versus tear us apart. The last 4 years, I don't particularly care about how well the stock market has done, and how the last 4 years for any American hasn't been, and for a lot of people around the world, has not been pleasant. I cannot believe that we're sitting here going, yes, that we want to repeat of the last 4 years for the next 4 years. We don't want that. We don't feel good about each other. We don't feel good about ourselves. When you have 350 million people living in a community where basically we count on each other to protect each other, you cannot have the divisions and divisiveness that we have. We cannot have a trumpeting from the center that pulls us apart. So my hope, my expectation is that we go back to leading, that leaders go back to leading. And we get all, you know, I'm just amazed that we are, as a country, where we are. We have to figure out a way to have as many people participate and be placated, happy, served, whatever it is, as possible. When you have literally 1% or less who wield everything, power, position, privilege, and a whole bunch of people who have nothing to lose, it doesn't work. Well, not for long. So my hope in the next administration, whoever runs it, is that we actually step back for a minute and say, is there a way that we can have America where we're not walking down the streets, if you're a black man looking over your shoulder, if you're a white man looking over your shoulder because you think the black man is going to take their job, can we just get back to building a better future for each other? Because that's for each other and for our kids. That's the role here. It's not about whether we can make another dollar, cut another iota of taxes over here, move the wealth from this pack to the other part. That's not what it's about. That's not what leadership is about, right? We can get the institutions to do that. We are here to assure that we are an absolutely outstanding nation.
Yeah.
And I tell you one thing, we're not on the path that we are currently on. I think that we can all say for sure. I live in London, and I tell you what they tell me, you are no longer this outstanding nation.
Hmm.
That's just not a good place to be.
This week was also a monster one for assets, nearly all assets. Pretty much everything roared higher, all except the dollar. But why is an uncertain election spurring such investor appetite? Is the blue wave trade on or is it off? It certainly looks like the Democrats still have a crack at taking the Senate in Georgia as it moves to a runoff, and Biden is, of course, inching to the White House. But what policymaking is the market backing now? And what is it baking in? We spoke all about it with Guy Labar, Janie Montgomery Scott, Chief Fixed Income Strategist.
Yeah, good afternoon, Joe. And I think you really nailed the kind of two sides of the scale, or the two push and pull sides, if you will, on the interest rate market. On one hand, we have presumably lower supply, at least lower than was expected supply, because, well, I'm assuming, rumor is that Mr. Biden and Mr. McConnell have had a good working relationship over the years, but I'm assuming that the odds of a large stimulus package in the short term are lower, and just as importantly, the odds of a large infrastructure spending package, which was a prominent part of the platform, are also lower. So that means a lot less lower long duration treasuries. But as you referenced, supply isn't the only thing here, right? We've got bubbling economic growth from a cycle low sometime this summer is bouncing. And, you know, best guess is that we'll get somewhere back to trend economic growth in 2022, thereabouts. And as we approach that sequel, you'd expect interest rates to rise. So I think really what's happened this week is that the interest rate rise hasn't been taken off the table. It's more been pushed back in terms of time.
Yeah, I am curious, Guy, if you could talk a little bit more about the economic angle, because we have focused very heavily on stimulus and, of course, the Treasury issuance. But there's sort of been a bet out there about, I guess, where we are in the economic cycle, whether this is a new economic cycle or just the tail end of the last economic cycle. And I guess where we stand in that picture seems to drive some investment decisions.
Most certainly. I mean, in the long run, the U.S. government represents, what, roughly 12% of the U.S. economy here in the United States, and the private sector is the other 80 to 90%, round numbers. But the bigger point here is that there's lots of forces of economic growth as you move up from a low. And while the nature of this economic cycle is extraordinarily different than any we've United States. Nonetheless, we are starting from a low point with weak unemployment, and over time, hopefully as employment continues to recover, it will pull growth up. The other component is that we've never had quite so many forces aggressively aligned to stimulate inflation. Now, we need to have some humility as to our ability as an economic society to cause that inflation, but nonetheless, we've never had so many forces pushing in that same direction.
How strong a force is the Fed at the moment? You kept me amused throughout the Federal Reserve decision yesterday with your live constant streaming of all things Bart Simpson. But nevertheless, there is a serious take on what the Fed was up to today, yesterday. And how much do you think that 2% or above will ever be hit?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, yesterday the changes were pretty subtle. They were very marginal. There was a little bit of discussion, as you referenced in the introduction, about maybe extending the duration of Treasury purchases. I think that's maybe a 2021 issue or concern. But, you know, the Federal Reserve has sort of, I don't want to say ammunition, far from it, but they've sort of laid out their stakes. They've laid out what they want and the policy path to be able to get there. And that's really the first time the Fed has outright pushed to drive inflation higher and said it quite so explicitly. Monetary inflation is probably just one of three-ish components of inflation, but nonetheless, they've never been in this position, and we need to be humble both that it might not work, but also with the chance that it might, right? And if inflation does reemerge to, say, 2% PCE, or call it 50 basis points at a minimum, too low on long-duration treasuries.
So you are the chief fixed income strategist at a time when people are wondering why allocate anything to fixed income, given how little it pays, given questions about the degree to which it serves as a portfolio hedge during downturns or periods of high volatility. What is appealing in fixed income right now?
Yeah. No, I completely agree, Joe. It's no way to get around low absolute returns today. And fixed income has become more important for sort of balanced portfolio ballast, is the phrase I like to use, to anchor and absorb some of the volatility. But it's also a great source of cash to be able to reallocate if we do get some incremental equity dips. generally where we're guiding clients is towards shorter duration on the interest rate spectrum and a little bit more aggressive in the credit spectrum. Hmm. Just as I said, economic growth is towards the bottom of the cycle. I would expect risk assets, and that includes things like high yield credit and investment grade credit, to do pretty well over the course of the next 6 to 12 months as the nascent recovery continues to gather steam.
Is there any case, though, to be made, Guy, about going a little bit longer duration? I mean, I know I understand the logic behind the shorter duration call, but if we are in sort of an upswing economically and that, you know, if we can, count on Jay Powell and company to keep rates at bay, why not go a little bit longer out in duration?
So I'm not as committed to the expectation that some of my colleagues are that the Federal Reserve will seek to squash any increase in long-term interest rates. I think it depends why that happens. If we actually get inflation expectations rising more materially, if we get economic growth resurfacing in a more consistent and stable way 6-12 months down the road, I don't think the Federal Reserve has any incentive to squash down on rising rates for that reason. So, you know, I don't think there's a need to go particularly long duration at present. The one sort of area or asset class that I think has value a little bit longer duration is wider spread assets. And that's because they're relatively cheap in comparison to other things out there.
While there may be new people coming into office, some things have not changed yet. On Friday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi urged Republicans to come to the table to negotiate on a further stimulus bill. But the White House and House Democrats still cannot agree a size of any potential relief package. We broke it down with Invesco head of U.S. government affairs, Andy Blocker.
I think that is the question. And I think the answer is, if Joe Biden is president, that's your best chance. I actually think that given the comments of McConnell and Pelosi, there may even be a chance to get something in the lame duck, a down payment on what you would do later when and if Biden is president. Biden is a creature of the Senate. He's used to working across the aisle. He has a great relationship with McConnell. I think that's the best play. But whatever's done is going to have to be agreed to on both sides. It's not going to be as big as it would be if there were a blue wave. It'll be probably less than $2 trillion as opposed to greater than $2 trillion. And they just have to work it out.
Can you talk to us about what the trade-offs might be, which bits live, which bits have to die on either side to be able to get some sort of deal done pre-end of the year?
Yeah, I think the key, there's a lot of issues out there, but the key issues on the Republican side are liability relief for businesses. If they're going to reopen, if they're going to open up during the pandemic, they don't want to get sued. And then on the Democratic side, I really think it's about state and local funding, replacing the revenue that's been lost in a lot of these states and localities. And if they can come to agreement about giving each other a little bit of what they want on each of those, not giving the huge $1 trillion that the Democrats were asking for state and local, and not giving complete immunity to businesses if no matter what they do, I think they can potentially get something done.
What about, the general sense here is that if this does drag out, Andy, into past January 20th and into the next Congress, Republicans are going to sort of have an incentive to maybe become deficit hawks once again. Mm-hmm. They'll have no incentive to sort of work with a Democratic president. Of course, this is presuming Joe Biden does win here. I am curious as to whether this becomes an impediment, not only for this fiscal stimulus bill, but really for the budget going forward and the spending measures that a lot of folks, including Jay Powell, say are desperately needed to keep this economic recovery going.
I think you're spot on. In fact, the Republicans in the Senate have already started reclaiming their fiscal responsibility credentials. Otherwise, we've already gotten a package this fall. So, yes, that is not only going to rear its head on any COVID-19 relief, it will also rear its head on any potential infrastructure stimulus and any other spending that Biden and the Democrats want to do. I mean, this really limits the ability for fiscal spending.
What else is there? I mean, we just talk about everything being spending 1 million, 1.5 million, maybe a little less. But of course, the government, in theory, does more than that. There's trade questions is one thing, regulatory questions, taxes. What else should investors be on the lookout for under the next administration, whoever it is?
Well, there are a lot of areas where I think both parties have indicated a willingness to work together. They've actually both want to do infrastructure spending. It's about how much. In addition, there's financial retirement packages that you have bipartisan support for that are coming together, the House and the Senate. And in addition, on healthcare, which you think you might not, not Obamacare, but on pharmaceutical pricing, on surprise billing. There's a lot of things out there that they could get agreement on.
All right, and while we're speaking to you, Andy, there's just some headlines crossing the wire that we just want to bring to our viewers here. This is according to Dow Jones. It says that Biden is set to tap Gary Gensler to be a Wall Street oversight advisor. Not quite clear exactly what that post is, but I assume that must be referring to the main post that would be coming out of the Treasury. Remember, he was a former Treasury official, of course, back during the post-financial crisis, and, of course, former Goldman Sachs executive. Again, this is being sourced to Dow Jones, Caroline.
Yeah, CFTC as well. Hillary Clinton, president campaign, he was the CFO there. Interesting that we start to get this drip feed. I think it's too quick to start thinking who's going to be in certain positions, and the particulars, we don't yet know who's won the presidency. But from your perspective, what are the key oversight changes that you're expecting going into the next 4 years?
Yeah, that's the right question. I think personnel, I think I heard that earlier on the show, because they dictate who in these. I think Treasury Department will send a signal on whether or not the administration is going to be in a moderate tone or more liberal tone. From a day-to-day, I think the SEC chairmanship and CFTC chairmanships are going to be important. And so those are the key ones, especially in the financial services world. But in energy affecting that, you're going to have the EPA administrator. And so there's a lot of places here where it's going to be very important to the place where National Economic Council, Council of Economic Advisors as well.
That's it for this episode of What You Missed This Week. If you like the podcast, make sure to subscribe and rate us at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And tune in every weekday to our daily market close show from 3:30 to 5 p.m. on Bloomberg Television and from 4 to 5 p.m. streaming on Twitter. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.